The Atlas Podcast is a platform where academia meets real-world narratives, where we don't just dissect but humanize global issues. We invite you to join us in reimagining a world where policy is not just about governance, but about understanding the human spirit that drives global affairs. In this episode of the Atlas Podcast, I will be interviewing Professor Al-Masri, who is a postdoctoral scholar with the Society of Fellows here at Boston University and an affiliate of the Department of Political Science. His areas of interest include comparative politics, security studies, and Middle East politics, and he is currently working on a book project titled The Rise and Fall of Radical Movements in the Middle East. So to get us started, can you just give us a brief explanation of yourself and your research interest and kind of what your path looked like to get you to where you are now?
Sure thing. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's great to be here. It's great to sort of engage students on, you know, the things that I sit in my office and think about all day. like you said, my name is Nasser Al-Masri. I'm a postdoc here, and I spent last year and this school year primarily working on my book project. And the book project focuses on radical movements across the Middle East. And I bring that up first because politics in the Middle East, particularly when I began college in 2011, I was vaguely aware of politics in the Middle East. My family comes from the Middle East. And so I always had sort of this background interest in politics and society, broadly speaking, in the Middle East, understanding the news that I'm consuming here growing up in the U.S. and what it meant for, you know, my family and friends back home. And so, particularly in 2011, when the Arab Spring broke out, I was a mathematics major. Actually, I was an applied math major in undergrad. I completely shifted my focus. I was asked so many questions. I went to school in Southern Illinois. I grew up in Chicago, went to school in Southern Illinois. And I was asked so many questions about my religion, about what I believed regarding politics, how to explain some of the most, you know, sort of well-known, groups or movements from the Middle East, post 9/11 and, even after the Arab Spring, with the variations in sort of activities that we saw across a number of countries. And I just started reading quite deeply about the history of the Middle East, how movements emerged and disappeared. And so I've had this sort of lingering interest in Middle East politics over the years. I pursued my bachelor's in political science and history, as well as a master's in international relations. I did my PhD at MIT. And as I was deciding what to do my dissertation, which, you know, would make the basis of my first book project, I went back to that founding moment sort of for me, if you will, which was, where the heck do these movements come from? Why do they matter? How do the ones that disappeared, at least ostensibly, how do they matter now, right? How are they resurfacing in different ways in these same societies? And so that was sort of the journey that took me through, was this genuine and deep-founded sort of curiosity about politics and society in the Middle East, and honestly having to answer questions to friends and classmates and the like. And so that's how I ended up sort of pursuing a PhD at MIT. And then I was fortunate enough to come here to Boston University to pursue this postdoc. And I've had the great fortune of teaching on similar topics. And it's been an interesting and enriching journey. It's also been a scary journey, I think, in some ways. I think there are many moments, not just even in the last couple of years, but even that preceded that, wherein I found myself questioning how open and honest I could be about politics, given the political environment that I'm studying in and operating in. And so studying and trying to uncover, you know, the truth, quote unquote, is not always easy, because you fear what the backlash might be. And not all, we're thinking of backlash maybe, you know, here in late 2025, we think of backlash as, it could be something related to the university or ICE. But even before, there were many topics, subtopics of political science or specific countries or areas that people didn't want to study because political scientists might turn their nose up at it or turn their heads away in fear that it would cause them trouble if they were to either publish your work or to hire you as someone who studies different areas. And so It's been quite a bizarre journey in that sort of sense, but you know, I've had great fortune to be able to continue pursuing my various research projects. So that's how I ended up here.
Yeah, I think that definitely shows how there's always been contention in these topics. And that's not necessarily something new. And also like the personal connection that so many people feel to like their areas of interest in this field. I think that's really critical and like why certain things should be brought to the forefront in this research. So going like more in depth into that research process and diving into these topics, can you explain the processes you went through kind of researching this book project? And is there any particular interaction you experienced that stands out to you during your research?
Oh, absolutely. So like you mentioned, the title, the working title of the book at the moment is sort of The Rise and Fall of Radical Movements in the Middle East. And the, you know, this project began during my, you know, as most graduate students experience this after their first couple years of graduate school, they're trying to explore what exactly, you know, I have a topic of interest, right, which mine was these opposition movements, but they need to, you as a graduate student, you're taught to sort of ask broader questions about what explains particular outcomes, right, related to these movements, at least you do in political science. And so I became particularly interested in a number of groups that we would loosely label Islamist groups, right? These are organizations whose priority is to spread some sort of Islamic politics within their society. I know a lot of people's minds jump to maybe like Al-Qaeda or something like that, but you know, an Islamist group actually ranges quite widely. There are those who are actually very close to the regimes in the states that they operate. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan had a very close relationship for a long time with the Jordanian king and the regime in Jordan. Whereas in Egypt, for a very long time, the same group, actually, the Muslim Brotherhood, had a very oppositional relationship to the regime in Egypt, the various regimes that passed through over the years. And so, you know, in pursuing sort of the study of Islamists, I realized something very interesting. I realized that a lot of these organizations, a lot of these Islamist organizations specifically, had their origins in the period of colonialism in the Middle East, right? Although this varies depending where exactly in the Middle East or North Africa you're looking at, most of the societies that experienced colonialism did so in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, right? So a much later period than the Americas, right? Other parts of Asia and elsewhere. And so particularly Africa and the Middle East experienced colonialism throughout the 1800s and early 1900s. And what's interesting about those opposition organizations that formed, there were Islamists among them, but they weren't the only ones. There were leftist organizations, usually communist, but a variety of leftist sort of ideologies, some of them socialists, some of them democratic socialists, right, and other sort of adjacent groups. And there were also a number of nationalist organizations, right, who were purely pursuing purely sort of national independence. So you have a variety of organizations. There's other liberal groups, there's other conservative forms of groups. There are groups with a variety of ideologies that were founded in the colonial period. And so what that means is that when we try to understand how Islamist groups develop over time, what we actually need to answer very carefully is, and how did they differ from other groups, right? And what my book sort of suggests is that groups that were founded in the colonial period, although they certainly had differences in content, differences in what they wanted the final sort of political outcome to be, right? They actually operated in very similar ways. They organized very similar types of street demonstrations. They published and tried to reach out to audiences in very similar ways. And most importantly to my book, they respond to repression in very, very similar ways, right? So in the colonial period, there were a number of groups that emerged to respond to the colonial presence in their territory, right? And they, you know, varied from communist, Islamist, etc. And the states that were formed, right? So in many cases, as an example, right, Iraq, right, was granted freedom. Egypt was granted, right, like independence, quote unquote. But in reality, the British were still present in their territories, right? The colonialism had not ended. And these opposition groups knew it. And so as they contested the British and these ostensibly free governments, they were repressed. They were excluded, right? And the reason was those governments more or less inherited the institutions that the British used to repress any opposition to their rule at the same time. Same thing in the French territories, Italian territories, etc. Right. And so what I find in my book is that actually colonialism helps inaugurate this sort of cycle wherein exclusivist states, meaning they exclude opposition from participating in government, they often repress them quite violently, are founded, and radical opposition is sort of founded. And actually, if you look at the other states where there's not colonialism, right, states in the Gulf and other states in the region, including Iran and Turkey, you don't see these radical groups emerge early on, right? It's not to say that those regimes couldn't have been exclusivist in some ways, right? But there wasn't mass radical politics on the streets. And so the book sort of pursues this line of thinking, right? What did colonialism do in each, sort of state across the region in terms of developing radical opposition? How did repression then shape their behavior over time? And that's the sort of the last part I just said there, the latter part, is what the second half of the book focuses on. How does repression influence the radicalization or moderation of a group, right? So if a group is already radical, we want to know, right, what we want to study and examine, which is what much of the scholarship on this topic has looked at, what situations, what dynamics, what crises force those groups to become even more radical or in contrast, to become more moderate. And I sort of suggest that actually all of these groups, despite their vast differences, despite being in different countries, those radical groups that were founded under colonialism and repressed initially first became more radical, trying to contest the state further, until they reached a point where either they succeeded, which wasn't super common, right? Succeeded in capturing the state, or more commonly, until they were repressed so badly that the radical factions more or less were either killed, exiled, right, imprisoned, or left organizing, right, politics. In all those cases, right, the organizations didn't disappear. They were captured by moderates. The moderates that remained within those organizations basically said, okay, we tried that radical route. It didn't work. We got repressed so badly. Some of them are in exile also, even though they were relatively moderate compared to the radical factions. And so those groups have this period of moderation where they're trying not to step on the toes of the regime, where they're trying not to contest, right, the regime's politics. At least not too directly. And in some cases, they align with the regime or participate in institutions where the regime gives them some space to do so with the intention of, you know, restricting them, not actually promoting their brand of politics. And so we get this sort of this move from radical to moderate. But what we see in the long run, especially in authoritarian context, is that opposition, right, the whole point of regimes even allowing them any space to do so is to further restrict their space, to be able to keep tabs on them, to provide them some space so they can say, hey, look, to the international community or to their domestic supporters, right? Look, we permit others to speak their mind, right? But at the end of the day, those opposition groups aren't permitted to really like pass policies or to reshape the governments in any meaningful way. Unsurprisingly, all of these groups then face backlash from within their own ranks, right? People at some point are saying, what are we doing? We're not opposition anymore, right? We are sort of cementing the power of the authoritarian regime because we're participating in their, you know, sort of institutions, whether they're national fronts or, you know, parliaments that aren't really allowed to promote certain policies. And so just to sort of recap, right, the colonial period inaugurates this sort of radicalism that first expands, then moves towards a more moderate state, and then, you know, this radicalism sort of returns. And I found that consistency across nationalist, leftist, and Islamist groups. And sort of one of the big conclusions of the book is we've focused so much on Islamist groups because especially post 9/11, but honestly, even post Cold War, right? It was the obsession of many Western scholars. And what I sort of suggest is that actually, if we pay attention to the origin of these groups and to other groups that look like these groups, meaning those that were radical in their founding, we see very, very similar patterns in their behavior. The very last thing I'll say is I've sort of been throwing around the word radical and moderate quite a bit. So part of what my book does is it reconceptualizes radicalism and moderation. I sort of envision them as being on a continuum, but whereas, you know, people have typically thought of radicalism as being the use of violence, many have found that, you know, many think that moderation is sort of equivalent with supporting democracy. And what I sort of suggest is actually that, like, democracy and violence aren't exactly the opposites of one another, right? They're very imperfect understandings of sort of similar phenomena. So as an example, I use this as a very rough example. There's a lot of, you know, asterisks that I would put on the end of this, but the American Revolution, which many people, at least that grew up here and went to American schools, understand, right, were used violence to promote their democratic, you know, ideal for a country, right? And obviously that's complicated by a number of factors, but in that sense, are they moderate or are they radical, right? We're left wondering with the way that we define it now. So I sort of define radicalism as those who want to usually quickly, but more importantly, thoroughly revise the way that the state looks. Versus a moderate is one who is maybe willing to reform a little bit, but is not interested in either quick or thorough revision of what the state looks like. And the last, very, very last note I'll say on that, you can be quite violent and support the status quo, right? So if I'm trying to categorize, ICE today, right? A violent way in maintaining, at least, you know, in some ways, a status quo that the state wants to promote. And so in terms of revising what the state looks like, right, we get into a little bit of murky waters, but it's not radical in the sense of revising entirely what the state looks like. The definition can certainly be murky and it has complexities. But I would say this is a violent attempt to maintain a status quo.
Yeah. So kind of going off that, this question might be a little abstract, but I guess how does the connotation of these words that you were describing at the end kind of influence how people talk about and how people discuss the like landscape of Middle Eastern politics today?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of ways in which, when we talk about violence in the Middle East in particular, whether it's coming from Palestinians or elsewhere, which I think has been, you know, the highlight of the more most recent sort of couple of years. One thing that I think is left out, you know, it's something I think Hannah Arendt and others have used the phrase mute violence, right? Where this is sort of a quotidian or day-to-day violence that occurs against people that doesn't make headline news, right? And there's a lot of ways in which, you can leave the Middle East or you can leave the present day and look at environments around the world. Violence is, there are many ways in which violence is used against people in ways that would never make those headline news. And it's not surprising in many cases, right? And this is about explaining, not necessarily justifying, but in order to understand when and how violence sort of erupts in many contexts, right? The number of civil wars since the 1970s, 80s, 90s that have erupted, right? Quote unquote, out of nowhere. Right, is really sort of a failure to look closely at how quotidian violence is sort of occurring against people. And that can be physical violence, certainly, right, being stopped at checkpoints, right, in South Africa under apartheid or in, you know, Ireland as another example. It could also be economic violence, right, where people are very specifically barred from accessing the needs that they have economically, from accessing healthcare, right? So I think often violence that erupts, it's very rare that violence is surprising. When we think about radical and moderate, right, it's beneficial for us to stop and say, okay, right, when people erupt in violence, right, A, what were the initial causes of them, including these mute forms of violence that we might have ignored, and B, is that violence actually radical in the sense that it's trying to upend a system that is, you know, morally good or morally bad, right? And second, and related to that, is it trying to do so through a rapid regime change or is it doing so through piecemeal reform? And so this is, I think, something that needs to be thought through and addressed a little bit more directly. I would state quite bluntly that anytime people say shocking, you know, violence that came out of nowhere, are often ignoring preconditions of violence that occur all over the world.
Yeah, totally. So to kind of pivot back to like all that stuff we've been talking about and back to what you were saying, like brought you to this research topic. So I know activism has played a role in kind of your research and your pathway here. So can you kind of explain how this influenced your experience in research and academia and kind of what that means to you in terms of your interests?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so as part of my teaching, I teach a class called People Power in Global Politics. The course broadly sort of surveys how individuals sort of at the non-elite level in societies engage in trying to change politics all over the world. And so having experience in community organizing, I think has had a profound sort of influence on my understanding of questions related to protests and politics and opposition in the United States and around the world. And it also has sort of shaped how I try to engage students and you know, through my research, my readers as well, in thinking about what is required at the individual level to A, change somebody's mind about certain policies, and B, even if they already agree, to get them off of the bench and into the game. And I think this is really, really important because it sort of in the background, I think, for a lot of researchers of protests and politics, is this sort of desire to not just teach people how politics works, how protest works, how organizing works, to try to affect change in whatever little or big way that you know, somebody's movement is sort of attempting to do, but rather to see personal stake in what's happening. I don't think we should study politics for the sake of studying politics. I don't think, right, and I'll openly admit, right, when I started studying this, I thought it was fascinating to study from this, like, nerdy, history-oriented student's perspective, where I was like, oh, this is so cool. If I understood all the movements, right, across the Middle East, this would be so cool, because then I could talk about them, right? And sort of the next question is, what is the value? What is the value if our learning and our researching and our teaching, right, and even our organizing, right, isn't actually oriented towards helping people, right? If I tweet with a bunch of expletives, right, to sort of get my point across, right, and three people like it, do I feel like I did something effective in the world? Or do I feel like I'm sort of speaking into the void and not actually influencing the outcomes? Now, obviously, right, there's a lot of ways in which politics is structured such that an individual's voice or influence feels like, right, it's not contributing much. You know, this is the old collective action problem, right? The old free rider problem, right? Like, why would I engage, right? Why does one voice extra, right, going to do in sort of shaping the outcome? But I think, I've carried these questions with me and I've answered them in a variety of ways over the years that has changed. But I think it's really, really important for people to sort of figure out what's going on around them. And if they feel like there's no policies or politics that they're engaged in, that's usually a newsflash for you that you're privileged in some way, right, that has allowed you to shield yourself from trying to engage in politics, and that you ought to try to, right, whether it could be at the political level, you could also engage in community organizing in a number of social ways that can support other people around you, right? This is, you know, something that has profoundly shaped the way that I interact with my communities, right? Both where I live, where I was raised, where my family's from, and beyond that even. And that has certainly shaped the way that I've thought about what opposition, you know, we think of opposition in such a grand sense, right? Like violence, massive protests, right? But there are a lot of small ways in which societies are trying to constitute and reconstitute themselves in face of pressures from authoritarian regimes, pressures from international institutions like the IMF and World Bank, pressures from world powers like the United States. And I think being able to write something meaningful that helps organizations understand, and forget organizations, right? People to understand their own society's histories and trajectories. I think that's meaningful as long as that education and that knowledge that is being produced is actually potentially beneficial, right, for people to better their societies, I think then it becomes extremely valuable. And that's how my organizing, that's what I've learned over the years from my organizing. And I'll add one last caveat on for those who are maybe in organizing and maybe, you know, you feel maybe called out. But I was once there too, right? I used to tweet into the void all the time thinking I was doing something. And, you know, maybe Twitter is not as popular as it once was, not even called Twitter anymore. You know, that's just something that for folks to think about.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I think most people are drawn into this field because they want to like shape the world and they want to execute change. But I think that can feel very hard in today's world where you do feel like you're kind of shouting into a void most of the time. There is kind of a lack of community. I just feel like with growing changes to our society with how everything's online, that's like a whole other topic. But I feel like it shows like the broader issues of like the lack of community change you feel like you can make. And I feel like that goes right into our last question, which I kind of just wanted to end with. What gives you hope? And that can kind of just be about anything. It can be specific to your research. It can be specific to broader trends in general, but just to be more positive about where you see the world heading.
Yeah, I think, you know, we could sit and have a whole podcast about revolutionary optimism, right? This sort of concept. But I think what I would say, right, for a lot of people, you know, obviously things can look bleak for a range of reasons and a range of times. I would tell you that I think if you go back and ask older generations, there were moments where they thought they had reached the bleakest points. And I think what you find in all of those bleakest moments is you actually do find, and often among students, right? Usually started among students, but also, you know, in broader societies, were sharp responses to those moments. I think people found ways through repression, through war, through, right, economic crisis, through all sorts of, you know, whether natural disaster or other types of devastation, right? People find ways to organize. So that gives me hope in a general sense. And one other thing that gives me hope, I think, is that, you know, as people feel like they're reaching quote unquote darkest days you know, in their society, and that might be in the US, it might be elsewhere around the world. There is a moment, and maybe this sounds depressing, but there is a moment where you reach a point where, well, things can't get worse, right? And at some point, people react in those moments in ways, whether they're very organized, like I was saying with student, you know, student sort of movements throughout history, or, you know, people sort of saying, this is enough, right? Like there's no way we can, you know, make ends meet in this sort of society or in these sorts of situations. And people respond. It's human to respond, right, to the ugliest of situations, the ugliest of repressions. I think that actually gives me hope, even though that sounds like it comes from a depressing place. I think it gives me hope because humans have an incredible knack for adapting. And I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for it. I do think being chronically online can hide some of the inequalities and the injustices that occur, right? While they make some of them blatant and make you feel like you can't do anything and it covers up other ones, I do think there's a way in which us, you know, we will adapt and have adapted, I think, in some ways to respond to those. So that does give me some hope. Very, very last thing, and I'll end with this, at least for this question, unless you have others. There, you know, if you think about some of the most repressive, you know, empires and individuals and groups, right, in history, none of them have ever lasted, right? They're blips in the radar of human history, right? And so whatever can feel so massive and unbearable today might be gone tomorrow and will be gone in a near tomorrow, right? Whenever that is. And so that's something that gives me hope. You know, it's some recognition that humans are actually, this is getting into philosophy now, humans are actually quite small, right? We don't know much of the existing universe. We are little individuals in the grand scheme of things. But insofar as we can even make a change that's a little bit bigger than ourselves, I think there's a way up and out of this.
That was a very beautiful existential way of ending. So thank you for the discussion today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is part of the Pardee Atlas, Boston University's graduate-run journal of global affairs. The host today was Logan Hall. I am the editor-in-chief, Jack Witten. You can see other podcast episodes, our published student writing, or find out more about our yearly conference at sites.bu.edu/Pardee Atlas.